So today we're going to be talking about pacemakers, how they impact your perioperative care. You know, we all have these patients, like a hip fracture comes in, they got a pacemaker. What are you supposed to do? You call EP. What are the risks? What about using the Bovi intra-op? What do you need to tell the patient? And what's all that discussion going on between anesthesia and the EP person, and you don't seem to really seem to know what's going on. So today I decided to talk to an expert. So I have with me Dr. Heath Saltzman. He's assistant professor of medicine at Drexel University School of Medicine in Philadelphia, section of cardiology and electrophysiology. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So I guess you heard my little spiel to start this off. You know, as an orthopedic surgeon, we don't even know how to read EKGs, but, you know, you sometimes get these patients that you got to operate on them. And, you know, what are the concerns we need to have when somebody has a pacer or an AICD? Or maybe I'll just start off saying, what are these devices if you just had to break them down?
Yeah, I think that's a good starting point. So I think globally you can divide these implantable devices as either pacemakers or defibrillators. Pacemakers are implanted to treat some bradycardic issue. So it could be a slow sinus node, it could be some degree of AV block. Defibrillators, on the other hand, their intent is to treat some tachycardia. And it's usually a ventricular tachyarrhythmia, ventricular tachycardia, ventricular fibrillation. And they can be patients who have had these rhythms in the past or patients who are at high risk for getting these arrhythmias. Defibrillators do everything pacemakers do in the sense they can pace depending on how many leads there are. They can pace the right ventricle. They can pace the left ventricle. But they also have the ability to treat these ventricular tachyarrhythmias either by fast pacing or by delivering shock therapy.
So I guess to get back to my perioperative scenario, so what are the, are any one of these devices like riskier than others, or how does a surgeon sort of address that situation when you've now identified what the person has and you have some idea about what that device does?
So basically, the things that I think are important to know before going into any procedure are, of course, is this a pacemaker or a defibrillator? And then if it is a pacemaker, is the patient dependent on the pacemaker? Some patients have pacemakers in place that really are utilized infrequently, and the patient is completely fine for even a lengthy procedure without direct pacemaker support. Other patients who, for example, with complete heart block, require pacing for every single heartbeat.
Now, how would we know the difference? I mean, how do you know unless you're, is it something you just see on a rhythm strip, or if you put a patient on telemetry, or just on an EKG?
So no way really to determine as far as if it's a pacemaker or a defibrillator based on the EKG. The big thing is size. And once you see a few, the pacemakers are about the size of a silver dollar. Defibrillator is going to be significantly larger.
If a patient doesn't know, you can tell on an X-ray.
You can definitely tell on X-ray. I mean, there are also other ways to determine based on looking at the leads, whether it's a defibrillator lead or a pacemaker lead. Oftentimes, patients know, and if they don't know, it's usually noted somewhere in the chart.
Now, what about, you said about the dependence, how do you know, I guess that's what I was getting at, how do I know if a patient is dependent on the pacer or not so dependent? That's, you were making a point about that.
Right. So if your patient comes down and they are not pacing, they have a heart rate of 70 or 80, and it looks like an intrinsic rhythm, you can generally assume that the patient is not dependent, or at least not dependent constantly on the pacemaker. Other patients may come down and they are pacing. They can be pacing in the atrium, the ventricle, or in both chambers. Some of these patients are going to be dependent, and there's really no way to know for sure in these patients except by having the device interrogated. And by that, there's a programmer that's brought down where we can look at what the underlying rhythm is. Some of these patients have an intrinsic rhythm. We actually want them to pace for specific reasons. Other patients have no intrinsic rhythm and require the pacemaker 100% of the time.
So when you come down and do an interrogation, that's one of the first things I guess you're looking for, is to see how dependent they are on the pacer.
Right. And that's the first step, and that's crucial. Because if there's interference with how the device senses, and most of this interference would come from electrocautery, you can have inhibition of pacing, and the patient can have ventricular or atrial asystole, which can be a big issue during a procedure. And it's also significant because with the electrocautery, you're going to have a lot of interference on your telemetry monitor, so sometimes you're not going to know right away that the patient is having asystole.
So maybe give me a couple of examples, maybe common examples that you've seen that are handled properly, or maybe a couple of examples you've seen that there was a misunderstanding perhaps, or you know, the expectation was not correct between, you know, the physician and or the between the surgeon and anesthesia, or between EP, or just, you know, ways that you've seen that handled properly, or when there's been confusion.
I think in, as far as examples of how it's handled properly is, you know, the cardiologist or the company representative given adequate time, so preoperatively in the pre-op area or even in the outpatient office, we can determine what type of device the patient has. Is the patient dependent on the pacemaker? If the patient is dependent, what we would then do in the operating room in certain procedures is either reprogram the device so they pace asynchronously, which means that they're going to pace no matter what. They're not going to inhibit pacing based on artifact the device may see from the electrocautery. Or what we would often instruct the operating surgeon to do is place a magnet over the pacemaker. Now, these magnets are often seen on the side of code carts. They're the round donut magnets. Placing a magnet over the pacemaker will automatically cause the pacemaker to pace asynchronously. So again, you can have electrocautery interference, but that won't interfere with the pacing. The device will pace at a certain rate, both in the atrium and the ventricle, no matter what the interference is. We often think this is a better alternative to our going in and reprogramming the device for the simple reason of you can put the magnet over, and when you're done with the procedure, the magnet comes off, the device automatically reprograms itself to whatever mode it was in previously, which kind of brings up what you talked about before, what you asked me before, as far as things that are not handled well. And the issues I often see is the surgeon calls the cardiologist or the representative to turn the device off. This happens during a change of shift where there's a misunderstanding about who's supposed to call who when the procedure's over, and the patient's device never gets reprogrammed back to its original settings. A little more on the device. Now, there are definitely times when the donut is the magnetic donut really isn't feasible. You know, for example, it's a left-sided device and you're operating on the left shoulder. You really can't have this big magnet in your sterile field. And that's definitely a case where we would go in, reprogram the device. Another potential situation, you're operating below the waist. The thinking is the electrocautery is not going to interfere with the device. But if there's a question, you're always going to be far enough away from the operating field where you can put that magnet over intraoperatively and asynchronously pace if there's any question about inappropriate inhibition of pacing.
Is there a downside to using the donut if it's out of your way?
There's really no downside, and I think for a lot of reasons it's going to be the safer option, especially if you're operating below the waist or on the contralateral upper extremity from where the device is. I always think that's the best option is the magnet.
So does it, when you say operate below the waist, does it matter where the grounding pad is? If you know what I'm referring to.
Yeah, so the grounding pad, you know, we don't want anywhere near the device. And I've actually seen a case or two, and I think this was in a hip replacement where traditionally the grounding pad would go on the thigh, it was put on the shoulder. And even though, you know, there was a question of why the patient was having inappropriate ICD therapy, was getting shocked during the procedure, even though the electric cautery was completely below the waist, and that was because the grounding pad was on the shoulder ipsilateral to the device. That kind of brings us, and I'll talk a little bit about defibrillators. Now, defibrillators, as I said, do everything pacemakers do, in addition to giving tachycardia therapy, so they shock or they can perform any tachycardia pacing. So you kind of have two separate issues. Some patients with defibrillators require pacing, and you can have the same issues of the electric cautery causing interference and inappropriate inhibition of pacing. Also, you can have oversensing where the device senses the electric cautery, misinterprets this as a ventricular tachyarrhythmia and tries to treat that by shocking the patient inappropriately. Again, similar to with the pacemakers, we generally think if you're below the waist and the grounding pad is below the waist also, there's very little risk of inappropriate device therapy. If there's a question of inappropriate device therapy, there's concern, or you're going to be operating above the waist, the magnet over the defibrillator does a little bit something different than the magnet over the pacemaker, where the magnet over the pacemaker makes the patient pace asynchronously. Magnet over the defibrillator does not affect pacing. The magnet over the defibrillator deactivates all the tachycardia therapies. So you can be operating again, for example, on the contralateral shoulder with a magnet over the defibrillator, and it will prevent the device from shocking the patient, even if it's sensing this inappropriate pacing. The magnet over the defibrillator does not affect pacing. So if you have a patient with a defibrillator who is the pacing dependent, that would require the device to be reprogrammed with the programmer.
Okay, so I think this is definitely helping me to understand this a little better. I think the key concepts sound like, firstly, identifying the type of device. Is it a defibrillator or pacemaker? Trying to determine if the patient is dependent on the pacer, and then deciding whether or not you reprogram or you put the magnet on for, you know, either asynchronous pacing or shutting off the, you know, tachyarrhythmia treatment. I guess that's some of the stuff I'm getting out of this.
Yeah, I think those are the major points. And again, you know, our thinking is if using the magnet is feasible, and I think it's always safe during the procedure, especially in patients with a defibrillator, placing the magnet if it's not going to interfere with your sterile field. Again, there's never going to be an issue of miscommunication where the device, the tachycardia therapies are turned off and the patient leaves and the tachycardia therapies are not turned back on. And there's also the issue of intraoperatively, you know, patients can have ventricular tachycardia, ventricular fibrillation, and it's a pretty straightforward thing. If that happens, just to remove the magnet, the patient can get the appropriate therapy for the tachyarrhythmia, and the magnet can go back on to prevent any inappropriate therapy.
Okay, well, that's great. That answers one of my last questions, which was, what if that patient really needs to have the treatment? And, you know, you're operating on them, you're creating a stress on their already stressed out heart, perhaps, and now they go into a tachyarrhythmia and you've just disabled the pacemaker, defibrillator, or whatever device there is, especially if they need a defibrillator and that's what they have it for. But I guess what you need is an anesthesiologist, somebody who's looking at the monitor to make sure that they pick up on any tachyarrhythmias and then let the device do its job. I guess one last thing to wrap up then, when do you need to have other devices on the patient? Is there ever, do they ever have to use, if the thing has to be disabled, do you ever have to have like any type of external pacing or Are there any other devices that a patient might need intraoperatively other than the preoperative reprogramming and the intraoperative use of the magnet?
I think short of some dramatic change in the patient's clinical status, as far as devices, there are probably not any devices. And when we do our procedures, we always have external defibrillator pads on the patient. And these can be utilized either for external pacing in the case of an emergency or for defibrillation in the case of ventricular tachyarrhythmia. So I think it's, when feasible, it's always a good idea to have the defibrillator pads in place. And, I think in my experience, it's infrequent that you have to use them. But really, in the case of an emergency, if there's an issue with the defibrillator failing or, even though very rare, a lead dislodging, having the backup pacing and defibrillation is definitely wise.
All right. Well, I think that was great. Answered a lot of my questions, and I think a lot of the questions of our listeners. So I want to thank Dr. Heath Saltzman again for his time, and wish us luck with those patients.
Great. Thank you very much. It was great speaking with you.